This is going to be really fascinating. There's a new book. You long-term listeners remember Michael Cremo. Michael Cremo, a brilliant scholar in the field of forbidden archaeology, has a new book out, but we're going to have him on in the future. What we have tonight is a man, Jonathan Gray, who has put together a book called Dead Men's Secrets, which is every bit as riveting as anything I've ever read in the field. It's just extraordinary. I've never seen more information packed between two covers about ancient civilizations which have vanished and so forth. This is going to be really interesting. Did you know, for example, and you find all this out in the book, that there is evidence of human colonies having existed on the moon and Mars, and this is all historically traceable. It may be subjective in terms of interpretation, but there are indicators that that exists. Also, that early cavemen wore clothes rather like ours. We've all seen, I think, those footprint tracks of dinosaurs and human feet side by side. Ancient footprints of humankind with clearly wearing sandals. This is amazing. There is also evidence that early civilizations performed open-heart surgery and other things. It goes on and on. Jonathan Gray has traveled the world for decades to gather data on ancient mysteries, and he's put it all together in this new book called Dead Men's Secrets. It is fascinating. Let's go now to Australia and say hello to Jonathan.
Hello, Jeff.
How are you?
I'm feeling pretty good, thank you.
Good. We got a good, strong connection here. A little delay, but that's fine. This is an unusual book. It starts out, if you want to take a book and just pick it up and look at the dust cover, on November 17th, the year 3398 B.C., 2 billion people with their astonishing technology vanished from the face of the earth. This lost super race beat us to the moon, computers, and a nuclear war. In part one of his book, Jonathan Gray presents startling information about the super civilization that was wiped out in a cosmic disaster, generating what may have been 6,000 foot tall tidal waves. The disaster known to early civilizations, of course, worldwide as the Great Flood, or the deluge, mentioned in the book of Genesis and the Bible, and so on and so forth. It's an extraordinary issue. We have postulated, I have certainly on this program for years, that civilizations have arisen over the millennia, over the eons, and crashed and burned for whatever reason. Now we have a book that brings so much detail to us that you just can't put the thing down. When did you start collecting data on this, Jonathan? How long ago was it?
Oh, about 36 years ago I began to, but I wasn't thinking of writing this book at that time, Jeff. Jim, I was really looking for something else, Jeff, and then suddenly a pattern began to come together, and I saw a book needed to be written.
Now, the pattern, I think when you began to see it, if I were in your shoes, I would have been pretty excited.
It was mind-blowing. I never had seen this world in this way before.
Mm-hmm. We're all taught so much, Jonathan, to think in terms of one time around, this is it, this is a one-off deal, first time intelligent life has controlled, manipulated, and destroyed the planet, but it's not, apparently.
Not at all. In fact, these people were intelligent enough to do everything we are doing or thinking of doing, including destroying one another.
Mm-hmm.
I found that this pattern actually was something that's on all continents. It wasn't just the odd out-of-place artifact here and there or the out-of-place legend, just one here, one there, which you could say is the figment of somebody's imagination. Here were solid objects, some of them sitting in museums, others in vaults, others just hidden away in private collections, and others still lying, waiting to be found, and which have been found over the years since.
We talk often about institutions like the Smithsonian, which have crates and crates and crates of inconvenient archaeology and archaeological artifacts locked away in warehouses and so forth. In your work, I would suspect that would come as certainly an expectation in your field.
You get to expect it when you know that something has been found in a certain place and it is stored away, and ex-employees talk about these things.
And
when you try to pursue it, there's friendliness at first until you actually say what you're after, and then the big wall comes up.
Your first chapter is called The Day the Earth Tipped Over. That's a pretty accurate summation of apparently happened. Tell us more about your theories, and there are more than theories, of course, but give us your ideas about the Great Cataclysm.
Well, this is something which had to have been triggered by an outside force. Velikovsky wrote the fact that there was nothing within the Earth itself that could tip its own axis. It had to be some outside force, whatever that force was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the axis tipped, it put tremendous stress upon the crust of the Earth, so much so that enormous cracks suddenly ripped open and out came lava and volcanic action and very hot water that spurted in enormous geysers into the stratosphere. And this rained down, of course, for weeks again, and I believe that there was a vapor canopy around the Earth, similar to what is around Venus now. There are a number of scientists who say that the geological evidence of the Earth is that it was like a terrarium from pole to pole. North pole to south pole was fairly uniform subtropical climate. But that this canopy which caused that was collapsed by this disaster, and then continents and seas were just churned up together. It was a real upheaval.
Do we have any suspicion in terms of your research that the Earth's crust itself spun on top of the magma beneath it, or moved in any way on a large scale?
This is quite possible. Really, we don't know enough about the magma underneath to be sure on that, but certainly we do. We can be sure of this, that where there was tropics in the past, it became very, very cold. You have, for example, down in Antarctica, the remains of huge coal beds which show forests. You have remains of enormous tropical animals that have been found under the ice. Up in the north, you have a similar situation, even fruit trees still with the fruit frozen on them. Mammoths, similarly.
Clearly,
there was a sudden climatic change which could have produced an axis tilt, or been generated by the axis tilt, or it could have been produced by a sudden moving over the magma, as you suggest, Jeff.
Indeed. All right. Stand by, Jonathan. Fascinating. This is a remarkable book called Dead Men's Secrets. You can find out about it by clicking on Jonathan Gray's name at Rens.com under guests. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back talking live to Jonathan Gray in Australia. And his book is Dead Men's Secrets. Now, these indicators that you mentioned before the last break, Jonathan, things of the Antarctic, things in the northern hemispheres that are completely anomalous and obviously indicate that something happened maybe in a matter of hours to the environment. Literally that fast. We just don't know. It amazes me that more attention isn't paid to these issues by mainstream science and aren't written about routinely. Now, that's one thing. But then we get to the astonishing piece of history called the Piri Reis map, which still boggles my mind. Tell us more about the Piri Reis map.
This map, Jeff, was copied in the Middle Ages from an unknown source. Many of the Middle Eastern, Middle-aged map makers attributed the knowledge that they had in their maps to sources thousands of years old, and as so did Piri Reis. Now, he showed very accurately not only the coasts of the North and South America and the Sahara as it was when there were still lakes and rivers there, but he showed the Antarctic as it was before the ice covered the continent. And he showed rivers where today glaciers flow, mountains that were only recently in our time discovered by geophysical surveys. And these were shown in a form that indicates that the map makers had some kind of surveillance similar to our aerial map making today.
Right. Somebody got a look from up above. There's little doubt about that. The map of the Antarctic without ice is apparently within, I've forgotten, but a very few percentage points of being virtually spot on the money.
Yes. anything that's not quite spot on, it could very well be due to the ignorance of the copyists later on.
Yeah.
The type of technology that must have been used would indicate that these people had the capacity to be very accurate.
Right, right. Okay, just one of the fascinating segments of Jonathan's book. So many things to talk about here. I don't know what to talk about next. Messages in the Canyon. That's a great chapter. Operation Spiderweb, an incredible electric web that gave one city world control. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Yes. Not only are there underwater channels, but there have been found by various researchers channels of electricity under the earth as well.
Are these involved with ley line energies at all? Are you talking about something different?
We're talking about ley line energies here, Jeff.
Okay.
And the ancient world, going back only 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, cited important structures at the intersections of these ley lines. They formed some kind of grid that went worldwide. And at these intersections where the lines came together, there was a great burst of energy. And
mm-hmm.
Pyramids, for example, were often located at the intersections. So were temples, and so were standing stones, various other structures of the ancient world. And these accumulated energy. And this energy, once accumulated, would be something akin to a power station, which mm-hmm. could then radiate that energy mm-hmm. and perhaps even have a controlled radiation that could go out to the countryside around.
Well, shades of Nikola Tesla.
Yes, definitely.
Now, this is
something that may have been a lot more perfect in the days before the great disaster, but
right.
Remnants of it are still seen today. We're looking at something that used to be very well mapped and very well known, but today we're looking at the ruins of what was once a great worldwide grid system.
Correct. I had scientist John Bedini, a brilliant man and friend, on some months ago, and we did a program about his research into, well, I guess the common term would be earth batteries or earth electricity, which is sort of related to what you're doing, and it has been demonstrated. It was demonstrated over 100 years ago that with the proper equipment, you could pull energy right out of the earth. Real simple.
Yes, if that's right. There's some interesting stories about that. And I heard of a scientist, this is not precisely what I'm talking about, but very similar,
uh-huh.
A scientist in Wales who was involved in the first French-British aircraft. What was that called?
The Concorde.
The Concorde. And he found some land out there in Wales, and he was able to get a handful of earth and run all of the electricity for his home on mm-hmm. one handful of earth for a whole year.
There you go. That's the same kind of thing that John Bedini explained. You can find that program in the archives, too, if you go looking for it. John Bedini. I think it was within the last year, and I think I reran it once at least. Lost survivors. Not everybody died in the great flood and deluge. There were survivors. It did seem after that, if in fact we are accurate, that man was in a very primitive, quasi-Stone Age condition. Give us your scenario about how things went after the great flood.
Well, at first, there would be knowledge of the past, of course, and there would not be enough people together to form a community to put that knowledge into operation. The same would happen today. Suppose a great nuclear blast came across our countries. The survivors would have to become savages virtually compared with their earlier way of life. They'd have to really go to the land. They'd have to work hard at survival. They wouldn't have much time for technology.
Correct.
And the memory of technology might be retained, but as soon as another community came together, they could then say, well, look, let's do this. Let's make it easy for ourselves. There's enough of us now to do it. And we do find civilizations springing up almost simultaneously across the world around about 3000 BC. We have Egypt coming up out of nowhere, virtually. The same with the Indus Valley civilization, the Sumerian civilization.
Uh-huh.
Specialists in these particular civilizations have made it very emphatic that their impression is these places just arrived out of nowhere, but with a ready-made technology and knowledge that they had inherited from somewhere.
It has always been of great interest to much of the world, certainly to look upon the Giza Plateau and the Great Pyramids, which seem to me to have been, I think, generally understood to have been built in the inverse order which they may well have been built. In other words, the older, allegedly older pyramids, the step pyramids and the more primitive pyramids, may have been built after the Great Pyramids, which we know about and are talked about all the time, the pyramids at Giza, of course, that they were imitations by peoples who came afterward to achieve what end, who knows. But the three primary pyramids, which used to be covered, of course, with that marvelous white limestone covering, clearly were designed for things that were almost anything but tombs.
Yes. It seems that they could later have been used as tombs, many of the pyramids, much the same as in Britain, Westminster Abbey is used to bury people, but it wasn't
yes.
built for that purpose.
That's right. That's right. So do you feel that the dating, of course, which points to maybe even 10,000 years of age for the Sphinx, according to some, and maybe even older for the Great Pyramids, is potentially correct?
I don't go along so much on the dating. I think there are some doubts about the dating. But, however, the order of events, yes, certainly I go along with that, definitely.
Okay. All right. Now, we talked about people coming back together and trying to resurrect civilization, as it were. We get asked questions, well, why weren't there repositories of knowledge that somehow were spared? Now, Edgar Cayce spoke of certainly three different locations where the records of Atlantis, if the Atlantean civilization was the one that that you indicate was destroyed, maybe 3,000 years B.C., why
yes.
no evidence? Why nothing found yet? And if, in fact, there were any treasure troves of ancient civilizations' accomplishments, why would we be allowed to see them, if you get my drift here?
Yes, I do. That's a good question. I can only speak theoretically here, but we do have evidence, however, that there were great treasure troves of information that were deliberately destroyed, or perhaps not so much deliberately destroyed, but not mm-hmm. knowing what their value was. For example, the Alexandrian Library in Egypt had a repository of ancient knowledge and science that contained 1 million books, and various people, including the conquerors of Egypt, the Arabs at one time came into Alexandria, and they spent 6 months burning the books to heat the city's baths.
Just incredible.
What a priceless treasure was lost, and how much differently we would view ancient technology if we could have that kind of information in our hands right now.
Of course, inexplicable how people could do that, but inestimable in its damages, of course, to our lost heritage. Okay, we're going to take a break, come right back, and talk about all kinds of things. Lost computers, secret tunnels, strange ruins on the ocean floors, and it's all in the book here, and this is a book that is loaded with fascinating information. Even the crystal skulls are covered in Jonathan Gray's book, Dead Man's Secrets. We'll do that in just a few minutes. Okay, we are back, and glad you're along. We're talking to Jonathan Gray, his new book, Dead Man's Secrets. He's been gathering material for 37 years for this book, and it is really fun to read. It's one of those books, again, that you can open to any page and start reading and be amazed. The entire second half of the book is loaded with references to strange objects which exist, legends, tales, historical records, artifacts, most of which don't fit in with what we commonly perceive of as our history. These can be oral traditions, a written or pictorial record, or actually a surviving object. And Jonathan has them all over the place. Dozens and maybe hundreds of them. I haven't counted them all. Just a ton of things. I mean, just when you open the page, let's just do this for fun. I'm going to open this page. Page 78. All right. This says Italy. Two Roman ships were found in the 1920s at the bottom of Lake Nemi, N-E-M-I. And between 1927 and 1932, they were restored. Unfortunately, they were destroyed by bombers toward the end of World War II. These were Roman luxury cruisers containing accommodations for up to 120 passengers in 30 cabins of four berths each, plus a cruise quarters. They were richly decorated with mosaic tiled floors, walls of cypress paneling, metal columns, marble statues, and paintings in the lounge. There was a library, a ceiling, sundial, a salon where a small orchestra entertained the passengers, a large restaurant and a kitchen, copper heaters which provided hot water for the baths, and modern plumbing with bronze pipes and taps. The underwater part of the hull was sheathed with lead fastened with copper nails. Pretty neat stuff, Jonathan.
Yes, we don't think about people being so sophisticated way, way, way back like that. But there's more surprises the deeper we go.
All right, I'm going to let you kind of lead the way.
Of course, sailed those seas much bigger than anything that Christopher Columbus had.
Yes.
There are records of ancient ships containing 500 crew.
500 crew members.
A pretty big vessel for that.
Now,
going
is that
over
the
oceans.
Are those the Chinese vessels?
Chinese, yes, and Phoenician as well. The Phoenician ones for the ocean were different from the Phoenician ones that sailed just around the Mediterranean.
Do we have any pictures or images or descriptions of those ocean-going vessels the Phoenicians had?
We do have descriptions where there was a fleet that went around through the Straits of Gibraltar and down the west coast of Africa, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of these had about 60 ships, each with 500 men in it. That's a lot of people. That's about 30,000 people went on this expedition. And they settled colonies all down the west coast of Africa, according to their ancient record.
Extraordinary. Now, as you all know, we have a lot of evidence left in caves and other areas that apparently indicate that the Phoenicians came all the way across the Atlantic, goodness knows what it was called back then, and made it up the Mississippi, up all the way to Illinois, and maybe even further than that.
Yes, I do believe that. In fact, I haven't written about this in Dead Man's Secrets, but it's information that fits in well with it. Information has recently come to light that Phoenician ships entered the Pacific. They came to Australia and New Zealand, or at least Australia. They sailed across via Tahiti and Samoa and left remains in those islands and finally reached the west coast of South America.
Now, according to interpretations of works by Plato and others, the Phoenicians were trading with indigenous peoples in America about 1000 B.C.
Yes, certainly. There is a tribe in the upper Amazon area which maintains that great ships from the east came across to the mouth of the Amazon, and these people came to a place called Ophir, which was the city that was on the mouth of the Amazon. The natives paddled their canoes down the Amazon for 3,000 miles from the tributaries, taking gold and silver to trade with these ships. And they heard of a great temple that was being built away to the land east of the ocean. So we just wonder whether perhaps the Phoenician-Solomon coalition was involved in that.
No, indeed. There was an American Rosetta Stone, so-called, which we know of as the Davenport S-T-E-L-E, found in 1874, had three different languages on it, all saying the same thing, which is what the Rosetta Stone was about, too. Tell me a little bit more about that one.
Yes, this stone actually, like the Rosetta Stone, one of the languages could be understood and the other two could not, but by careful comparison it was found to be a linguistic pattern between the three, which showed there was the same story. This steel actually indicates that there was definite trade between the New World and the Old. These peoples were not isolated. They knew so much about each other, like we do today.
Right. Now, we also have coins found in the Western Hemispheres that shouldn't have been here. There are so many things, and again, just going through the book here, each page has another surprise. This is a record that just does not get attention, as it should, and I can understand why not. It would upset the current comfortable paradigm of history as we are taught it. But it gets to be a little silly when the evidence becomes so overwhelming, as you have portrayed in your book, that you just can't shut it off. Now, tell us about more of the mechanical devices. Now, the Antikythera computer remains one of the great...
That's an amazing one, Jim.
Absolutely one of the great finds in modern, and I'm going to use this word, known intentionally, archaeology, known archaeology, because there have been other things found quite clearly. We can go back to the Grand Canyon and shortly after the turn of the century and the alleged caverns with Egyptian artifacts found in there and so on and so forth. That's another story in itself, but tell us more about the issue of the Antikythera computer.
Yes, this was found on a shipwreck in 1901 at the bottom of the Aegean Sea. And gathered dust in the Athens Museum for about 50 years. It was coated in an incrustation from the ocean, and so it was very difficult to clean it until a new method was thought of. Then it was found, it was about the size of a portable typewriter. It was found to contain an ability to calculate the positions of every heavenly body going back any time into the past or any time into the future, and its relationship to the Earth in the solar system. Plus, this gave the ability for any ship anywhere in the world to sail out of sight of land and know where it was, longitude-wise and latitude-wise.
Wow.
This, of course, blows the theory that they had to sail within sight of land for fear of getting lost.
Sure.
Dr. Dela Sola Price, who examined this from Cambridge University, he stated that this find was like discovering a jet plane in the tomb of Tutankhamun. That's how revolutionary this is as far as the archaeological world goes.
Sure, sure. Now, where is the computer now?
I believe it is back in Greece. I can't guarantee that. The last that I knew, it was back in Greece.
Well, that single piece of technological competence remains, in my estimation, as one of the most amazing discoveries of our time, quite frankly.
Exciting one, yes. You can throw so many theories out the door once you've got that in your hands.
Okay, what other artifacts have we to look at? Now, we've got the famous Baghdad battery, which unfortunately has gone missing.
Yes, that's a sad one. It's fortunately not the only one that's been found. I don't know the locations of the others, but I'm aware of 14 that have been discovered.
Same thing.
And these have been, one of them was tested. The one that has gone missing is the one that was tested, found definitely to be an electrical battery, no doubt about that. And electroplating has been found all over the world, from the Inca civilization right across to India. And this indicates that what we today need electricity to do, these people were already doing.
In terms of...
Something else has been found too, more recently, and that's... micro-artifacts up in the Ural regions of Russia.
Okay.
Spiral-shaped artifacts, Jeff, which are microscopic. They're constructed according to the five proportion, which was known as the golden section. Some inexplicable, highly advanced technology, thousands of years old, and we are only just beginning to start using such micro-miniature devices in our latest technology nanomachines.
All right. Now, why aren't these discoveries being trumpeted widely and talked about? They're not being covered up because they can't be at this point, but these are profoundly important discoveries. They're just not getting the press that they should.
Yes. Well, I guess it depends on publicity. You know, there are archaeologists who are very good at finding and identifying what they have, but they're not really good at publicising their finds. And we need people like yourself to let the world know that these things are being found, and this is why I so much admire your program, Jeff, and I think so many people tune in because they want to know these things.
Well, I agree, and it's my great honour to be able to do this kind of work, and we're talking with Jonathan Gray. He is in Australia. We have a good clear line, but there's about a 2 or 3 second delay, you can tell, so we're working around that as best we can. His book, available by clicking on his name at rents.com, Dead Man's Secrets. And it is it's a terrific addition to our ancient history, lost strayed or stolen from it. It is said that mathematics is the most important language of all, and looking into our known ancient history, we have some amazing stories of math and mathematical formula that were used by ancient cultures, which may not have been so backward as common history treats them. Give us some examples of mathematical achievements, if you would, Jonathan, of our known past. And again, we can't go back to what we don't know any longer, but what we do know is pretty extraordinary.
Oh, yes, it is. I guess one of the most well-known structures in the world is the Great Pyramid in Giza. And if you measure that very, very carefully, you'll notice that the length of the solar year, the sidereal year, the various other components of the astronomical movement of our Earth through the solar system are all miniaturized by measurement in the dimensions of the Great Pyramid. There's one example.
Mm-hmm.
We also have records of very small fractions of mathematical calculation going into millionths of a second. And this implies that there was some kind of technology to measure it, because when people talk about something can happen at this speed, you obviously expect them to be able to back it up by saying, well, how do you calculate that, or how do you know? And these people were calculating in micro fractions of seconds and measurements. That really tells us something about how far they must have been.
There are, again, page after page of examples in the book of ancient knowledge. Mexico, Egypt, and Peru had a decimal system. India, Mexico, Babylonia, China, and Peru also had the use of zero, upon which all math and science basically operates sooner or later. Geometry, you know about that. Euclid's classic triangle problems were studied 1,700 years before Euclid was born, even. We consider Euclid to be the father of geometry, but it was old news.
Yes, geometry and the use of algebra, trigonometry. Trigonometry is actually reflected in the construction of the exact the exact correlations within each component. It shows a knowledge of trigonometry.
Mm-hmm.
In Babylonia and in India, the tables of astronomers were used to work out the positions of heavenly bodies. They used algebra to do that.
Algebraic tables were known to ancient Indians. It almost seems, doesn't it, Jonathan, that maybe some of the strongest indicators of ancient advanced civilizations are to be found in the older writings and manuscripts of Indian culture. India seems to have been maybe spared such total annihilation as were many other parts of the world.
I think that's one of the secrets that has given us such tremendous insight into ancient India, Jeff, is that the destruction there was not widespread. In fact, it was small compared with what happened in the Americas and in the Middle East and in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And this is good. And also China was spared quite a deal. We have quite a great deal of information from ancient China as well as India. These Asian nations have provided us with tremendous insights into the ability of our ancestors. In other parts of the world, things that we see talked about in China and in India, we see smatterings of them in other parts of the world, which suggest that there was a global pattern to this knowledge,
mm-hmm.
but that in other parts of the world, the information was destroyed by invaders who came into those old countries. During the Spanish conquistadors' adventures into South America, for example, they destroyed a tremendous amount. In Mexico and in the Maya country, they burnt every book that they could rest their hands upon.
Oh, and, they literally eradicated their heritage, right.
The writers of some of these books committed suicide. Mm-hmm. They screamed in agony as they saw their books being put to the flame, and then many of them committed suicide because their whole life work had gone down.
Yeah.
That's a very, very sad story.
It's beyond sad. Words almost don't adequately paint the picture. The issue of metallurgy remains one that continues to be more than fascinating. what they were able to do, even in our known history with metals, was extraordinary. And again, it's something we don't talk about much. But as we slip into this break, the matter you brought up earlier of the micro artifacts, the almost microscopically small, obviously advanced pieces of something, continues to be very exciting to me.
Yes, and the materials that many of these were made from.
Right.
I don't know if I pronounced this correctly, but those items found up in Russia were made of copper, tungsten, and molybdenum. Is that how you say it over there?
Molybdenum.
Molybdenum and tungsten today are used for hardening special steels and
yes.
for the filaments of light bulbs and giving anti-corrosion properties to tools.
Yeah.
And here we find these are the components of these very ancient little artifacts, which are microscopic, and show evidence of intelligent manufacture.
Now, steel was around, we're going to a break now, but steel was around at least 2,500 years B.C., a steel mill with 200 furnaces, about the oldest factory known to us, was found in Armenia. Extraordinary. Various places
yes.
around the world where steel was found, steel objects were found in Austria, pre-flood, India, Britain, Armenia, there's Armenia again, and England, a wheel rim. It's remarkable when you start adding up all the pieces of data that Jonathan Gray has put together after 37 years of collecting. Be back in just a minute with more. Okay, we're back talking with Jonathan Gray about our ancient history, which has been in some cases hidden away from us. We don't have access to it. But it's there, and it's collected in many cases. Again, it's a kind of a book that you look, and every page you look at has got something else that you can want to trace to another section. There are, again, pictures, microscope on a... This is an interesting chapter here. Chapter 15, Jonathan. Microscope on a sexy spider. You got to tell
yes,
us about that.
Yes, a little spider that uses the tip of its third leg, it's shown on a ancient picture high up in the Nazca Plateau in Peru.
Sure.
Now, this little spider has this little sexual act that it performs, and it inhabits caves in the Amazon jungle. Now, to see this little act, you have to put it under a microscope. Yet these people drew this spider in the performance of this act, and they drew it in a huge, giant picture on this plane that can only be seen from the air.
Well, the work of Eric von Daniken and others at Nazca, extraordinary, and for all of you who've seen documentaries about those images, quite clearly only designed to be viewed from above, and certainly a great distance above as well.
Yes, so you have two implications with this drawing. First of all, that there must have been a knowledge of getting up above the ground by one means or another, flight or whatever you want to suggest. And secondly, the ability to see something with the aid of a microscope.
Now, you talk about microscopes and optics. The ancient world has yielded some pretty interesting artifacts in itself. There was even what looks like a ground lens found in, I guess, in a burial chamber in a tomb in Egypt.
That's right, yes. And lenses like this, Jeff, have been found off the coast of Ecuador in the ruins of a city that's several miles off the coast down on the seabed. They've been picked up in the northern Australian desert and in various other unlikely places in the world, dropped by somebody, who knows who, many, many long years ago.
In India, mirrors have been found with ancient mirrors with two reflections. Highly polished circular magnetic mirrors found in Mexico ground to the precision of truly optical lenses. The Olmecs in Mexico had very small miniature concave mirrors. You mentioned Ecuador, a convex obsidian lens 2 inches in diameter, which functions as a mirror and reduces but does not distort the reflection, so precisely made that the reflection of the face shows the tiniest hairs. Concave mirrors in Peru, lenses in tombs in Libya, lenses and reflectors have been found in South America and Crete and on and on and on. And there are pictures of some of these in the book as well, just to give you another idea. I just wonder if someday we're going to find a real hidden repository of some unbelievably ancient knowledge that will forever change the way that this corrupted view of history is being marketed and forced on people.
Well, Jeff, if I find something like that myself, goodness knows who's going to do it, but somebody's sure to do it one of these days.
Sooner or later, yeah, it would
seem. I'll call you first, and you can tell the world about it.
Thank you. I'd be happy to do it. Okay, some more of your favorite parts of the book, and again, as I just, I haven't had a chance to read the book. Just go through it and look, as I said, page by page, and some of the items are just, they're stunning. Ancient cities. Some of them had walls 23 and 24 feet thick. It just goes on and on and on.
Some of these cities, of course, are not even excavated yet. In fact, in South America and Central America alone, there are estimated to be at least 3,000 unexcavated cities. Who knows what's going to be found inside those when someone has the time to get into them? 3,000. Mm-hmm.
Just in South America.
And more have been found through satellite in the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
It appears that cities were built before some of that jungle took over, and now these cities are choked by vines and trees, and the ruins are there, huge stonework, enormous buildings, which would proudly grace any town today. And these cities are all over the world. Some of them are off the seabed. There are thousands of cities off the seabed. Looks like the sea has risen several hundred feet over the last few thousand years.
Correct, yeah.
There's so much that has not yet been discovered, but we know where many of these cities still lie, waiting for somebody to do something in them.
In Cusco, Peru, you've got a picture in the book of the wall stone with 14 visible sides, each of which interlocks exactly with adjoining stones. Now, I don't know, and these are huge. We've seen these before and talked about them before, but they are they're truly extraordinary. Some of the walls in the ancient hemisphere that we call South America. All right, let's pause here now, take our break, and we'll come right back with Jonathan Gray in just a couple minutes and talk more about his book, Dead Man's Secrets. Okay, and we're back. Just some of the other things in the book, and that, again, this book is loaded, are ancient weapons and weapons systems. Now, you've got a picture in here, in the weaponry chapter, of the skull of a prehistoric bison. And right in the forehead, in the middle of the forehead of this skull, is a perfectly round hole. Tell us more.
Well, ballistic tests show that it was a firearm that did this damage, and it was not a spear, not a dagger, or some old-fashioned weaponry. It was something that went as fast as a bullet, and it hit the skull, went straight through. Now, somebody might say, well, how do you know that this wasn't a modern hunter who did this? Well, the answer is that a close examination, forensic examination of the skull shows that this animal, which is a prehistoric animal, survived. The calcification took place. In other words, the wound began to close up. And that had to happen while the animal was still alive.
Sure.
So somebody in prehistoric times was using weapons as fast as modern-day rifles.
So many things here.
There's also a human skull found with the same thing, Jeff, and
that's now in the British Natural
History Museum in London.
Yeah, they have a human skull from a very early period of history found 60 feet underground. On the left side of the skull is a hole, again, like with the ancient bison skull, perfectly round. No radial cracks, as would have resulted from an arrow or a spear. Only a high-speed projectile could have made such a hole. The left side of the skull, directly opposite that little hole, is shattered, having been blown out from the inside. Same feature is seen in modern victims of high-powered rifle shooting. So, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. There's the bison story. I'm just thumbing through these things. Other weapons, rocket torpedoes were developed by the Arabs, ancient Arabs. Landmine development was achieved by Hannibal to destroy the Roman army. Bronze-lined portable flamethrowers, so small they could be carried like a pistol in ancient Greece. It's extraordinary. Solar mirrors were used by the Chinese and apparently the Greeks to incinerate the enemy. Electromagnets withdrew the nails of ships as a means of destroying the enemy. How's that? In ancient Arabia, they used powerful magnets to pull the nails out of ships to sink them. Fire that burned in water, a chemical warfare weapon manufactured by a formula which included petroleum and naphtha and sulfur, was self-igniting. It was delivered by rockets, catapults, or through flamethrowers, and on striking other ships would continue to burn despite water being thrown on it. Actually would burn on water. Nerve gas, said to be used in ancient India. One of the quotes from the ancient scriptures and texts there. Poison was produced, covering the earth with deadly fumes, which stupefied the poison that would have destroyed the world. It's fascinating. The Chinese had poison gas bombs as well, I guess, going back to at least 1000 B.C. Go ahead, John.
Yes, we are not taught these things in school, and we tend to assume that early man was just coming out of something pretty primitive, and that we are the brainiest people alive on Earth. I'm beginning to doubt this the more I see what our ancestors were able to do, Jeff. They could teach us a thing or two even now. In fact, in this book, I think there's something like about 52 items that are ahead of our own scientific knowledge.
Right, I wouldn't be surprised if there are more than that. It's an extraordinary compendium. India, and again, I go back to what I said about India. Seemingly, the Indians didn't suffer as extensively in the great catastrophe. They understood the molecular composition of matter. We can tell from the writings. Here's another quote, translated, but it's accurate. There are vast worlds within the hollows of each atom, multifarious as the specks in a sunbeam. That is, the atoms which themselves contain particles are, however, mostly empty space. I mean, this is amazing. The Indian knowledge was, the ancient Vedic writings were, still I don't think that they've been fully understood by many people at all here in the West. I think the Indians understand it, but we don't.
Yes, that's right. And they also have the atomic divisions of time. Talking about 100 millionths of a second. Now, however could they have even contemplated talking about such things unless they had a reason to know something that was at that speed?
Mm-hmm. Well, the ancient Sanskrit text about what appears to be atomic weapons continues to just amaze all those who read it. This is in 2449 B.C. An Indian text recounts in great detail how aircraft were used to launch a weapon that devastated three cities, 2500 B.C. The record of this apparent attack is unnervingly similar to eyewitness reports of a nuclear blast. It describes the brightness of the blast, the column of rising smoke and fire, the fallout afterwards, shock waves, heat waves, the appearance of victims afterward, and on and on. It talks about radiation, or what we'd assume would be radiation poisoning as well. That in India.
And interestingly, to offset the effects of this radiation, a person could save himself by taking off his body all metal and immersing himself in water. And washing away contaminated particles is the exact method used today.
Mm-hmm.
The horror of these things are described in these old ancient documents. And there are not only documents, Jeff, but there are remains radioactive skeletons have been found in
the Indus Valley civilization
in the remains of cities.
Right.
There was a British explorer, H.G. Hamilton, who in the late 19th century was up in the northeastern area of India, and he came up across some ruins. His foot actually slipped through the ground into a hollow space below.
Mm-hmm.
He dropped down into it, and he found himself in a long, narrow room. And the walls were glazed with tremendous heat had come through. And he actually looked at what looked like a table, and another object looked like a chair, with a statue sitting on the chair. And he was horrified when he looked closer and found that inside that glass statue there was a human skeleton.
Wow.
Now, we still don't know enough about nuclear energy to know of the varying effects of it, but this man swore when he got back to Calcutta, and he was recognised as a very level-headed man, an honest man of integrity, and he could still recount the horror of what he saw,
mm-hmm.
and experts have said that nothing but atomic energy could have produced such results.
In Israel, in 1952, archaeologists unearthed at 16-foot deep level a layer of completely fused green glass, a quarter inch thick and covering an area of several hundred square feet, made of fused quartz and sand, and very similar in appearance to the sand at the atomic test sites in Nevada and in the Gobi Desert as well. So we have more and more evidence of ancient, awesome weapons and what appears to be nuclear power. Why not? Look where we came from the year 1900 to the year 1945. Let's jump ahead to the year 1930 to 1945. 15 years we had basically created the technology needed to unleash the power of the atom. So, not a surprise.
One interesting thing, Jeff, is that where there seems to be evidence of such explosions in the past, these areas are adjacent to where new agricultural communities sprang up, communities that did not have technology and we look upon as Stone Age. Now, among these communities, there were legends of something greater in the past. So could these be survivors in each of these areas that we've been coming upon rather than Stone Age people who came out of nowhere? Could they have been the remnants of civilizations long past because of such disasters?
Right. In Turkey, archaeologists came upon thick layers of burned brick. The blocks had been fused together by heat so intense that it penetrated more than 3 feet below floor level, where it had carbonized the earth, skeletons, and burial gifts that had been interred with them. That's kind of the enormous heat that can only come from one source that I recognize. Are there evidences of vitrification of fused green glass in many countries, which indicates a potential of a past world war, a nuclear world war?
I don't believe we are the first. Certainly there is an uncanny parallel here between what's being found from the past and what we are able to contemplate today.
The technical brilliance and knowledge of what we call antediluvian civilization was, according to what you're saying and what's in your book, so astounding that it does appear to outdistance our achievements, at least in many key areas right now today. I don't know how much further we can go. We appear to be close to making the same mistakes, Jonathan, that our ancient ancestors may have made with technology that gets out of control.
Yes, you only need one madman to start doing it, and the whole world gets involved.
Only one madman to release a doomsday virus or a doomsday bacteria, and that's the end of the game. And we have those kinds of organisms now sitting in various laboratories. We know of two of them that have been talked about and publicized. Doomsday organisms. There are probably others. So, yeah, one crazy person who has a real bad day can mess it up for all the rest of us. Jonathan, do you go around and give presentations and talks about this?
Oh, I do. I've had prime ministers fly in from adjacent countries and lawyers and doctors and housewives and others fly in to just to see this stuff. I love sharing it. Sometimes I lie awake at night and talk to my wife and say, hey, you know, is this real?
Yeah.
We know it's real, but it's hard to grasp it when you grow up thinking that there was nothing much in the past, and suddenly it's like stepping onto a new planet, Jeff. It's our own planet in the past,